Hi, my name is Robin, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Sally will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Sally. I'm an alcoholic. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Mike will read the steps.
I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And these are the 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
And Kate will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Kate. I'm an alcoholic. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name Bless You to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Nick B.
Hey, I'm Nick B. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Mike B. And my sobriety date is December 12th, 04. Can I just say that it is AA takes you to weird places. And like, I'm a Orthodox religious Jew. I'm sitting in a church in front of like 400 people, and Jesus is like staring down at me behind. The weirdest thing is that I sort of feel comfortable with it, you know? but that's honestly, like, that's one of the miracles of AA, because like, I wouldn't feel comfortable if I was in synagogue with like the biggest rabbis, you know, like growing up, and like here I am, I could, wherever I am, no matter where I am, I feel comfortable. Okay, so my sponsor said that I have to tell you how I earned my chair here. So I don't want to go into a whole history, but for me, I always go back to the first time I got drunk, and it sort of sums it up, and it's sort of like a broad picture of everything else that was to come. The first time I got drunk, I think I was 13. I mean, like, I tried drinking before that, but the first time I got drunk, I was about 13. I remember going, it was one of those Jewish holidays called Purim, where basically everyone gets drunk. So, you know, that was the perfect opportunity to try it out. So I did that. So I got totally smashed off my face, went to like a giant party. And that's basically all I remember, except for certain things. Like waking up and throw up with things I know I didn't eat. Yeah, different things. You know, I remember scavenging the tables for any left bottles because my drunk was starting to go away. But one of the most significant memories of that night is that I went up to one of the dorm rooms in the school, and someone had a bottle of wine. And he's like, you know, you could have this bottle of wine if you want. And I'm like, okay, you know, sounds good. So I was on the second floor, I think, and I was walking down the floor, the two stories of floors, drinking the alcohol. By the time I got down, I was like a little confused. I was like, okay, I'm not, you know, I don't see what the big hype is so much. And I guess wine sort of has a weird way of creeping up on you. And it all hit me really, really hard, like the second I got to the bottom step. And I remember there were these two double doors, sort of like the doors to the church here. And like this feeling washed over me, like as I hit the bottom floor. And I was like, for the first time like that I can remember in my childhood, like my head stopped talking, which was a really, really comforting thing to me. Like I remember always my head talking and talking, and like for the first time it was just calm. And I was like, this must be how like regular people think. And I remember those two double doors, and like, I don't remember, I think it's the movie Gladiator, where he walks out into the arena in slow motion, and there are these huge like iron doors, and he's sweating and everything, and he like pushes them open, and he's like there in all his glory. And that's exactly how I felt walking through those double doors. And I push open the double doors, and I come out, and I'm like in a coat closet or something. Yeah. But that didn't take away the feeling of, you know, of how good I felt. But I was like, you see that fur coat? That's me. And I was like, but the point is that I felt totally comfortable with myself for the first time. I felt like the man. You know, in the big book, Bill W. describes it, you know, he says, I had arrived and I could not have put it better. Like, I knew, like, I was smart or whatever, but this is the me. This must be the me. And I remember, like, one of the first thoughts I had in this stage was, we have got to do this more often. And I promise you, I did not fail to adhere to that voice. Since that day, I went, at any chance I could have, I remember I would go away for the weekends to my friends, and we would get drunk at their houses. And I'm not going to lie, you know, I hear a lot of people say, you know, like, it was horrible from the first drunk, you know, I lost my house, my wife. It wasn't like that. Maybe because I was 13 and I didn't have a wife or a car to lose. It could have been that. But I did have some good times, you know, at 13 years old, getting drunk, it was fun. You know, and I did experiment with other things, but I think alcohol really, you know, was the thing that brought me down. Because no matter what, you know, like, I could say, like, I used other things, but for some reason, alcohol is like the common denominator across it all. And so from that day on, I basically did everything in my power to, you know, get an opportunity. At first, it was away from home. Then eventually, it didn't matter anymore. You know, I went away. I left my home at ninth grade. And basically, from there, what happened was anything became doable to get what I needed to get. People could be trampled. You know, it didn't matter anymore. I lied. I stole. You know, I hurt people that love me. I realized I had a big problem with about what people thought about me. So if I just acted really badly to everyone and I knew they hated me, it was much more comforting to me. My bottom came when I was totally spiritually bankrupt, physically. My body was deteriorating. I started to get those shakes that they talk about, which I didn't know anyone else got till I read the big book. I was 17 at the time, and I tried to commit suicide by, you know, I didn't really have the guts to do anything, so instead I would just, like, put a mattress up against the wall and flick cigarettes at it, praying to God that it would light. The end of the night ended up me crying on the phone with my mother, which was humbling. And the next day I was brought to a detox rehab facility. They told me I would be there for 30 days. I was there for a year. I was there for a year because I was a special, you know, special client. It took me a while to get the hang of it. But the biggest favor they did to me was they introduced me to AA. And when I got out, I did what they told me. Actually, when I was in rehab, someone came to speak to us, and he was from the Atlantic group, Stacy. Black Stacy, I think they call him, but I like to call him Man Stacy because I don't know any other Man Stacy. So he came to speak and I was like, that guy's going to be my sponsor. He told me that when I get out, there was a big meeting, you know, a celebration of AA or something at the Hilton. And I'm like, Hilton? Okay. And I went and I saw him there. And at that time, there was a lot of things going on. I ended up getting another sponsor. And I ended up with my sponsor, Michael Belly, who's my present sponsor. He's been my sponsor for about 3 years. I went through the steps with him, which I could say is, like, crucial. Like, you know, people come here and they say, you know, I go to meetings and I stay sober. And honestly, I don't understand it because I went to meetings a little bit without doing steps. And it was hell. There's no other way to put it. Like, until I got better, you know, like, it was sort of like, okay, I wasn't drinking, but I was miserable until I did those steps. I remember the first step for me was just the ability to believe that maybe there is something besides myself that's controlling my life. And, like, I opened that door a crack, and it, like, burst open with the sunlight. And it sounds cheesy and whatever, but, like, the second I opened the door a little bit to let God in, he took over my life, and it's been progressively better ever since. I'm not going to say I don't have, you know, worse days, but, like, bad days are like okay days now, and okay days are good days, and good days are great days. You know what I mean? Like, I've never had a day like I had when I was drinking. I was going through the book with my sponsor, and towards the end, there's a paragraph about a contempt prior to investigation. And when I came into these rooms, I had abandoned my religion. I had piercings, shaved head, you know, and when we went through, you know, the steps in the book, and we got to that paragraph, and he's like, so do you think there's anything, you know, that you might have contempt for? And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? And he's like, how about your religion? Weren't you brought up Orthodox Jewish? I'm like, yeah, but I investigated already. I mean, I was brought up it, you know, how much more? He's like, you didn't do anything. You know, you were brought up. I probably know more about Judaism because I dated a Jew. And I was like, I said, okay. And it was only because I had the willingness to listen to whatever my sponsor said. And I'll tell you about willingness. At first, I didn't have the willingness to listen to everything he said until he introduced me to his sponsor, Peggy. Peggy sits up here in the front row. And the role that she's played in my life is every time I want to fight with my sponsor, Michael, about something, he says, you know what, why don't you go ask Peggy about it? Why don't you call Peggy, see what she has to say? For some reason, when that happens, a light goes on and I see the way. I see that my sponsor knows exactly what he's talking about, and I do whatever he says. But because of that paragraph, I went to Israel for the past 2 years. I've been in Israel. My concept of God is constantly changing and growing. I've accepted my religion again, and you know, I don't recommend it for all, whatever, to each his own. But it works for me, and I went to Israel. I had the most incredible 2 years, and I've been growing, and every day is honestly a blessing. The blessing that I don't have to get up like in my own urine or vomit is enough. The fact that I have something inside me that like no one can take away. You know, I could lose my car. I don't have a job right now. I don't have anything, but something that makes everything okay that I never had until I came to AA is inner peace that no one could take away from me. Thank you.
Our second 10 minute speaker is Lisa F.
I'm a little short. Hi, I'm Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really nervous. My sponsor told me that if I wasn't nervous, that wouldn't be a sign of humility, and that I don't know everything, because I clearly don't. And I'd just like to start out with my sobriety date is I'm going to have 6 years on the 21st of this month. I have a sponsor, Amanda, is my sponsor. I'm working steps 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 10 on a daily basis, and obviously 6 and 7, because I'm not perfect. I grew up in New York City. I come from a wonderful family. I have a mom and dad and a brother, and I had it everything as far as, like, things that are, like, tangible. Like, you know, I had, like, all the material things that, like, a young girl would want. And I guess there was something missing because I was never actually, like, happy. And I was never satisfied. And I never felt, like, a part of. And, you know, I guess, like, so part of that is just, like, growing up. You know, not feeling a part of and, like, just trying to figure out who you are. And I guess I can still relate to that in that sense of the word. I initially used alcohol to, like, gain self-confidence because I never felt I was like cute enough, smart enough, pretty enough. I guess I was just never enough and I didn't love myself, and maybe I didn't even know what loving myself was at that time. I just knew that I was unhappy. And then I don't even know why I kept drinking, because the first time I drank, I got drunk on one wine cooler, like this like Australian beer, and then I ended up just like throwing it up. And the funny thing is that basically continued throughout my sobriety. Every single time I drank, I never knew where I was going to end up, who I was going to end up with. But the one consistent thing in my life was the fact that every morning I woke up and I felt morally bankrupt. And I felt, you know, less than... I was a serious blackout drinker. So, like, I have a few stories I'll probably tell you, but I don't even remember half of it. And that's, like, that's not really life, and that's not really living life, you know? And it's such a joy to wake up and, you know, just live life today. Well, not all the time, to be quite honest, but... and basically, every drinking story goes as this. I have one drink, and then I have 7 drinks, and then I black out. And then I end up in usually some guy's room because I use men to get self-esteem, and obviously that's not helpful. And then I wake up the next morning, you know, like I said previously, feeling so bad about myself. And the funny thing is I kept on doing it over and over and over again. And that's the funny thing about alcoholism. Like, we're so self-centered and so into ourselves and what we're doing and what we're thinking and all this stuff, and here we are killing ourselves and hurting ourselves. You know, it's not normal, you know, waking up the next day and, you know, getting sick till like 7 o'clock the next night and then getting ready to drink again that day. It's not normal to, like, you know, give, you know, just you have people abuse your body because you're so blacked out and you didn't remember anything. And that's just not normal. And I remember story after story, like, I woke up one night, and then I woke up one morning, and I had Band-Aids on my hands, and I don't remember any of this, you know? And then, of course, I was told, because basically I lived vicariously through other people because I didn't remember anything. Like, I literally had to have people tell me, like, well, what did I do last night? And you know, I used to hide. I used to hide all day that day. I lived in a sorority house. So everyone basically knew if you, like, you weren't there that, you know, something happened to you. And I would hide with my friends on campus. Like, hide from people. You know, so nervous about what I did. You know, it, like, alcoholism, like, alcohol, like, took away my choices. And that's not what it's like today. You know, I don't want to live life not being able to, like, you know, have the opportunity to improve myself. Because I know that I'm still a progress in, you know, in the making. And I know that, like, you know, those times that, like, you know, in the morning when I felt so sick and less than and morally bankrupt, it just means I have no freaking morals. So I want to just explain that. You know, never changing, you know, using alcohol to cover up whatever I was feeling. Like, initially it was just to, like, you know, fit in. That was the initial part. And I guess everyone kind of goes through that. But then it was more like, there's clearly something wrong with me. Like, there was, I was never happy. And then, I didn't want to say, but the thing is that my therapist who's here tonight, which I'm really happy about, she was like, well, you know, you never, you know, you do the same thing over and over again. And you come in here and you tell me the exact same story and you feel really, you know, so and so forth. And I was like, well, no, because, I mean, everyone else does this. Like, I was always hanging out with people that drank as much as me. And, you know, I always was comparing. I was like, well, you know, at least I'm not doing cocaine. At least I only smoke pot occasionally. But here I was, you know, doing this, you know, waking up every morning and getting sick. That's no life. That's not the life I live today. And so I came in at 23, and I was really, I was sick of feeling the way I felt. I was willing to go into the program. I knew that, like, after college, my therapist was like, I think you should go to outpatient, and I was totally willing to go to outpatient, because I remember towards the end, I was like, I don't want to drink anymore. I mean, I don't know that I want to drink anymore, but I don't want to feel this way, I suppose. And then, so then I went to rehab, and I was on cloud nine. I mean, to be honest with you, it's, you know, some people don't relate to that, but I was on cloud nine because I had not lost anything. I had my family, I had my friends, and I felt really good. I really reached my bottom in sobriety. And that's when that's when all the old feelings were there. So you know what? The only way that those feelings change is if you work the steps. You know, if you come to meetings and, you know, you occasionally talk to your sponsor, you occasionally do some of the steps. I didn't half drink, so why would I half, you know, do the program? You know, the thing is that, like, once I work these 12 steps, like, the miracles start happening. I mean, life is not always wonderful, and I don't get everything that I want, but as long as I believe in my higher power and that he's guiding me and that I'm right where I'm supposed to be and that he has, you know, that he has a plan for me, I really can't go wrong. And, you know, sometimes my faith falters. But, you know, the one thing I don't do is I don't stop going to meetings. I don't stop talking to my sponsor. I ask, how can I improve my program? So then I started, so recently I've just been starting doing 10 steps, calling my sponsor at a time so I could definitely talk to her, because I know we all try to avoid our sponsors. I'll call them at this time because I know they can't, that's the time I can't talk to them. But I'm not, there's, the great thing about this program is I'm going to grad school in the fall, and it took me 3 years to get there. It took a lot of pain and walking through a lot of fear, but that's what this program gives you, the ability to walk through fear and anxiety and reach your dreams. And the longer you stay sober, the more chance of this has come true. It took me 60 years to have my dream come true, but now it's happening, and it's because of this program. It's because of the steps. It's because I don't have to do this alone anymore. And I can't live without praying every day. I pray every morning and every evening, and I don't remember all the time because I'm not perfect. But I can't live without my higher power. I can't do this alone. I can't. And every time I lose faith in my higher power, that's when I'm miserable. And I have that point. And I also have the point where it's like, I know if I pray long enough to have things removed and I work my program that they pass. Thank you. They pass. And that's a guarantee. I mean, it's we all want, like, we're alcoholics, we want it right away. We want everything to change right away. And you know what? It doesn't, unfortunately. We're in the hands of God, and we work on His time. And maybe it's not how we planned, but, like, I'm not feeling that great right now. I'm moving, and I'm following my dreams, but I'm anxious. I've had drink signals for the last 2 weeks. I'm frustrated with the packing. I'm stressed out. My mom's here. She's driving me crazy. But I love her to death, and she's doing all these great things for me. And without the program, I wouldn't be able to do this. I wouldn't even gotten to grad school. And without the program, I couldn't even know that I'm on my way. I couldn't even function, you know. And now I think the one thing to remind the newcomer is now that we have choices. You know, we don't have to drink every day. We don't have to drink every other day. You know, we have choices. You know, and opportunities. And the miracles to come. And you know what? Sometimes it takes a long time, but if you stick with this program and you trust in your higher power and you really work the steps, because that's where it comes from. It doesn't come from, you know, me. I get drunk. The steps and talking to a sponsor and doing that stuff, that's when the miracles happen. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Jeff G.
I'm Jeff. I'm alcoholic. Great to be here at my home group, the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Dayton. I'm in steps 10, 11, and 12. And my sobriety date, September 29th, 1996. I've been in New York since January of 01. And let me tell you, this group is amazing. You know, as I look at all the people I know through this group and how much impact they've had in my life, so positive. And I want to thank Peggy and also Van. When I got sober in Montana, it's not in the Midwest. It's actually out west. But people confuse that with Missouri. They're actually mountains and all that. But I came back to check New York out. I wanted to move here and take on the world like a lot of people that come to New York. And I went to the 79th Street workshop, and I got a card from Van. And I didn't know who he was or anything. He came up to me after, because I introduced myself as I was visiting. And he's just a great example of the program. And I know we all miss him, but he lives on. So, so with that, why am I here after, coming up on 12 years? And certainly there are people here for a lot longer than I've been here. And it's because I have alcoholism. If I just had a drinking problem, as you've probably heard other speakers explain, I would have quit drinking and moved on with my life. But I have this disease called alcoholism. It's a condition of the mind and body, and it's a spiritual malady as well. And, it manifested itself in me, long before I took a drink. And when I found alcohol and when I picked up a drink at, I don't even know. I mean, I really don't know whether I was 11 or 12, or I know I was Genesee Cream Ale. I didn't forget that. Pretty gross. But it really did make, it was my solution. I mean, alcohol became my solution from a very young age. And, I compare it to just, kind of going into the corner, into a warm, dark corner, and just feeling better. And from very early on, alcohol was my solution to everything. Whether it was I was happy or excited or wanted to celebrate, or I was very depressed and angry, alcohol was always the answer. And so my alcoholism this state of restlessness, irritability, and discontent that the Big Book talks about. The solution I originally found was not Alcoholics Anonymous. It was alcohol. And, you know, I pursued alcohol into the gates of insanity and death, like the Big Book talks about. And the thing for me and most alcoholics was it was a very progressive disease. And, you know, I started off in a regular household in America, loving parents, a sister. And, you know, pretty soon I was drinking a lot on the weekends. I was 15. My best friend crashed his car and then shot himself with his father's gun. Right then, I made a decision, a conscious decision, that I was going to drink as much as I could, whenever I could. And, you know, I was determined. Like most of us are very determined people, you know, whether it's alcohol or something else. We're going to do it come holy hell. And, you know, I somehow made it through boarding school. I did win a chair. This big pink chair goes to the biggest drinker of the. When you're a junior, you get handed this, and the chair was called the Pig. And you know, I have an interesting story. I met with the director of development at this boarding school a couple of weeks ago, and he showed me a picture from my senior page. It's very embarrassing. I was really wasted, and that was my senior page in the yearbook and everything. And there's all like this code language I was using too. Like they didn't understand that. I somehow thought that they didn't know what I was doing, and it was funny. So he's like, "What's your deal now?" You know, he saw me, you know, Midtown Manhattan, and he's trying to raise money, and I've given a little in the past couple years, and he's kind of like, "We never thought you would really be the kind of guy to, like, what happened?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't want to go into a lot of details, but, you know, I shared a little of my journey with him." But that's sort of, you know, an example of what's happened. Once, you know, a completely sort of ruined situation on the men because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so anyway, I made it in a good college. I lasted 1 year. I went to Tulane in New Orleans, and I was on the one-year program, apparently. After that, I went and slept on someone's couch in the Bay Area for about a year. I'm sure they loved that. It's my roommate at boarding school. It's his sister. But you know, I thought that was fine. So I was in Berkeley, and alcoholism progressed, and the drinking progressed, and the solution all of a sudden, you know, became warped in my life, and all these negative things started to appear. Appear probably abruptly to people around me. It was more subtle for me. I was kind of having a good time. I wasn't working. I was getting into some illegal activity. Nothing major yet. I mean, later, at the sort of depths of my alcoholism, I started collecting guns. And I mean, that's not a good time to start that collection. But, you know, I was kind of a harmless hippie for a while. And I know I don't care what people look like, if anyone's here with dreadlocks and a beard. But that's what I look like for a while. And, you know, I didn't go to the hair salon for the dreadlocks. I didn't brush my hair for years. And, you know, that was interesting hygiene. You know, but it was pretty cool. You know, so I was peaceful for a while, but I got, you know, I started living in a van and traveling the country, and the Grateful Dead was a big part of my life, and frankly, I still love the music. I mean, I listen to it all the time. But when I got sober, I had to take like a 2-year break. I had to separate myself from it. And I'm glad to be back on the bus, but I'm sober. I drive my wife crazy. We have Sirius Radio, and Channel 32 is a dead channel. But it just progressed. So soon, you know, I was at college, and then I was kind of living in a van and going around the country and making a living. And, you know, I sold grilled cheese for a while. I've never seen a help wanted sign for grilled cheese makers, but I did acquire that skill. I even made some jewelry, and but soon my need to get drunk and to give myself relief. I mean, I think we can all relate. I mean, I started to have this screaming inside me, this real pull, and I couldn't help it, and it was growing, and the voices and the drum beat, and the only way to quiet that down was alcohol. And again, I pursued it harder because it was the solution. And to sort of cut to the end where I was collecting guns. So I was very peaceful for a while, and I was into that movement. And I ended up in Montana. I was in Montana for a while, and I ended up living up in the mountains in a log cabin. No, I'm not Ted Kaczynski, or I'm not related. He was about 40 minutes away, though, and I wasn't eating squirrels. I wasn't eating. I mean, it was not funny. This disease kills people, and it's very serious. And you live alcoholic torture. And, you sometimes wish for the end. Now, I bounced in out of institutions, more county jails. I somehow got away from prison. I was thinking back to, I got pulled over in New Jersey once, going to a dead show at Giant Stadium, and the policeman, I was lunging back after he got me out of the car, I was lunging back in the car to try to get something and eat it. But he threw me on the ground, and he called me Charles Manson. And, that was when I was still kind of healthy. You know, I ended up in the log cabin. You know, I was having seizures, and I was spitting blood. And, you know, my friend was, trying to help me when I'd had these seizures. And they tried to get me a detox. And I couldn't see anything, any solution. I just pursued that into rehab, and I got out of that. I went to one meeting, and it scared me. And a week later, I couldn't take it anymore. I drank, and I drank a lot. I had bought a case of gin. It was really bad. But I bombed out again, and I was actually on home arrest. I kind of recommend that for people. It kind of helped because it set up a structure, and I still think structure is good today. Dayton wanted me to mention my... They told me I had to get a job, or they were going to put me in a jail, or I had a 3-year, so maybe prison, I don't know. But I had no skills, and I had jaundice. I was really unable to function. Don't feel sorry for me. I'm an alcoholic. I got a job at Taco Bell. Dayton always calls it Jack in the Box, but I think it was a step up, really. There are no burgers. That was my most valuable job. And I'm serious, my most valuable job in my life, because, I showed up and I washed dishes, and soon after several months of 5 hours at a job, I was going crazy. I mean, I couldn't handle it. But I did get promoted to, I stood outside with the change thing, like the middle of winter in Montana. It was tough work, but the biggest change was I got into AA, and I went to meetings every day, and I found a sponsor, a gentleman that died 2 years ago, Jim H. He lived in Missoula, Montana. He had, I think when he passed away, 30 years of sobriety. But the biggest part, most of the people in this room, this group's wonderful and so active, he just loved the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he poured himself into it, and he sponsored me and spent tons of time with me in this book and at meetings and going for hikes and teaching me how to live a sober life. I was looking at things last night, and reminded me my ideas did not work, but the God idea did. I was able to just take all that and give it to God. And I still do that every morning and every night and during the day when needed. It's given me a lot of relief. But faith without works is dead. We set out a rigorous path of action. And doing the steps and the inventory and cleaning out my wreckage of the past. And it was just an amazing turning point in my life. And I got very involved in service there. And the coffee, I was tricked into doing the coffee. He had like 24 years of sobriety, and he was doing coffee at a meeting. And that's what it's all about. Then this is also what it's all about. He said, "Jeff, I'm going on vacation for a week, and I want you to do the coffee this week." Well, 2 years later, I was still doing the coffee. But that got me showing up early. It got me talking to people, and it was instrumental in my sobriety. So. We had fellowship in the rooms, there's service, and there's recovery through the steps. And the amends process for me was very difficult. It was facing a lot of people. I had this weird thing, even though I wasn't working, I was a complete failure. I had jaundice, I was completely dysfunctional. But I had some like weird pride or ego going on. Like, it was really weird. I was at my parents once visiting the last time. It was a couple years before I got sober. I got all upset at them, and I caught like a limo or something. I think I only had $90 on me or something. But I had some strange, delusions, grandiosity. I had to shake that, and it talks about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, and these are essentials and requirements of the program, and they were then, they are now, I thought Nick and Lisa did a great job with those, and just that's really what it's about for me, and what it takes for me to stay sober. As I said, the disease for me is staying sober is absolutely the most important thing for me, but I can still become very sick of my alcoholism without drinking. I still seek sense of relief. And as I said earlier, alcohol became my solution and gave me relief from all those feelings and those fears. And today it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the steps, and it's talking with other alcoholics, it's reading this book, and it's also remembering who I am and being honest with that. The solution and the program has brought many things into my life, and I think Nick said it very well, is most of the time having inner peace and feeling good about life and the people around me and being able to share life with people, friends and family. Most important, I have a great relationship with my family. I was married last June. And we're expecting a baby in September. Oh, that's a little bad. I'm supposed to read all these books. I haven't yet, I have to admit. But I'm pretty excited about it. But it's I'm not working at Taco Bell anymore. And there's certainly nothing wrong with Taco Bell. But I've been extremely fortunate and lucky to pursue things I love to do and benefit from that. So there have been lots of rewards that way through being sober and working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's the biggest reward is really being able to live and enjoy life and have an inner peace and not be running around, frustrated all the time and looking for a permanent solution and using a temporary solution. So if people are new here and, I can remember how that is and the build up and the tension and I just need a drink. But it's only temporary and it stops working. And right here in these rooms and in this book and with a sponsor, you have a permanent solution as long as you work on a daily basis. And that's the biggest gift of all, that this I can have it one day at a time. I can have this gift of sobriety. The last thing I want to say is, that I really am grateful for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, in these rooms especially, but all over, where there are meetings and people are showing up doing service and people are lending a hand to the sick and suffering alcoholic or even the happily sober alcoholic. And I'm blessed. I feel blessed to be a part of this fellowship. And thank you very much.